My name is Stephen Bells. I'm 34 years old. Today is October 4th, and we are in Baltimore, Maryland. I will be interviewing Dr. John Casale, who is both my mentor and colleague. So.
My name is John G. Casale. I'm 52 years old. Today's date is October the 4th, 2007. We're in Baltimore, Maryland at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society Conference. And I'm pleased to be interviewed by Steve Bells, who is a former student of mine and a longtime colleague.
Okay, John. Let's begin today by having you tell me what it is you do for a living.
Well, I'm very fortunate to be a college professor at Virginia Tech, and I direct an acoustics lab there that primarily concentrates on issues of noise impacts on humans.
Okay. A minute ago, you mentioned that we, for everyone here, that we're at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society. Could you tell us a little bit more about what Human Factors is and your expertise within this area?
Yes, Human Factors, or ergonomics as it's sometimes called, is a discipline that focuses on the design of systems that humans use in one form or another. And our main thrust is to optimize those systems such that they are more efficiently and safely used by people and that people get the maximum benefit from those systems while using them. My particular expertise is in the area of auditory or hearing systems, which would be any device that provides a signal to a person or presents music or, for example, is a warning signal. We also deal with issues in the design of communication systems, such as for the aircraft cockpit. And in our laboratory, which is called the Auditory Systems Lab, we deal heavily with the impacts of noise on humans, which can constitute anything from issues in noise-induced hearing loss and how to prevent that from occurring, noise annoyance, such as would come from a community setting where there might be an industrial plant or a roadway that keeps people awake or bothers them when they're in their backyards, or issues of speech interference in a variety of settings, such as in a conference room or an auditorium.
There seems to be an ever-increasing trend for people wearing earphone or earbud-type devices for listening to music or other audio content, talking on the cell phone or other things like that. Has this trend created any human factors issues? And if so, what are they and how are they being studied or remedied?
Well, actually, the proliferation of on-ear or in-ear devices has created some human factors issues, and they're fairly recently being studied. We're talking about devices such as earbuds that would provide music at the ear or other types of ear inserts that might be used for communications type devices. And one of the big issues is that consumers' daily listening amounts have increased by a staggering amount because these devices are very convenient to use, and of course they're quite portable in the sense that they can be worn while the user performs other activities. People wear them while exercising in gyms or walking on a city street, or even sometimes in the industrial workplace. And, for example, in the realm of music, a person can listen to music, of course, all day long through these devices, as compared to my years in college where we did have our stereo amplifier and loudspeakers, but those existed in our apartments or our houses, and we listened to them, you know, perhaps too loudly sometimes, but it was usually only for fairly short periods during the day. I began to notice issues with ear insert type devices, particularly music players. When I'd pass university students in the hallways at Virginia Tech or in the elevator, and they'd be wearing such a device, and standing 5 to 10 feet away from them, I could distinctly hear certainly the melody and even some words of the lyrics coming out of their earbuds. And I became a little concerned about the sound pressure levels that may be present at the ear in those situations. So I took a few of these devices off the students as they were wearing them and put them on our acoustic mannequin. And this mannequin is a device that has artificial ears and microphones, and we can measure the output of earbuds and ear insert devices with a mannequin. And we found that at some of the settings selected by some of the students, the in-ear sound levels were quite high. And that wasn't the case with everybody, but it was with some. And also, it really opened our eyes in doing audiograms or hearing tests on college students, as we often do in our research. We were finding that about 20% or so of our students didn't meet the criteria of so-called normal hearing, and that normal hearing would be a criteria that's needed for some types of testing that we do that have to do with hearing protectors and other devices. So when we found that students had or showed such a hearing loss, and it appeared to have the profile of a noise-induced hearing loss, and we interviewed them, sometimes they would tell us that they were heavy users of music players. That wasn't always the case, but it certainly was the case in a number of students. And the problem is that they had more hearing loss than would be scientifically predictable for their age. Everybody's going to experience some hearing loss just due to the natural aging process, but when you see noise-induced loss that has a specific profile in the audiogram, it's quite troubling.
So apparently there are some issues with these devices as far as presenting a hazard to human hearing?
Well, we suspect that there can be, but there needs to be more scientific research to look into this issue. We certainly know that because the devices are so portable, so convenient to use, and many of them are quite comfortable, that there's an increased exposure that's simply due to very long usage periods, you know, several hours a day and up for some individuals. There's also just an increased exposure due to the fact that there are so many applications of these devices. People can listen to music, they can listen to books on CD, cell phones play through ear inserts with some products. Some people have two-way radios that are playing through ear inserts. You can even get a GPS system to help you navigate that'll talk to you through the earpiece. So just the number of applications would tend to increase the amount of exposure at the ear. There's even other issues associated with the quality of the sound that these high-end devices provide. That is, the better devices provide distortion-free sound at the ear, have very low power requirements, and use very high-quality and efficient loudspeakers. So their frequency response, their lack of distortion, leads one to use them more frequently and perhaps for longer periods of time, and the sound is clean and distortion-free.
Human factors often deals with the intersection of people using technology. Has there been any human factors research into these types of issues?
Yes, there has, and there needs to be a lot more before we have the definitive answers. But, for example, there's been some questions about should these devices be used in high-noise situations, and we've looked into that a bit. We know that there can be potentially increased exposure to sound output through the devices that are due to what I'll just call signal-to-noise ratio issues. That is, if, for example, a person working in industry wore a music player and there was background noise in this person's work area, their tendency would be to turn up the earphone volume simply to overcome what we call a masking effect. That is, they need to increase the earphone output so they can hear the music over the noise, and that in itself can present a hazard. So this effect of signal-to-noise ratio issues combined with the long periods of use increases the sound exposures at the ear. So we know from our work that it's definitely not good practice to use earphones for particularly music listening or really any other content. It could be just simple speech content through the earphone. When you're in a high-noise environment, unless, with the exception, that the earphones would be specifically designed to attenuate ambient noise in the vicinity. And then, depending on the circumstances, and it's very situation-specific, it might be acceptable. Another thing, and this is really, I think, has become a concern to some members of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society. It's also a major concern of some members of the National Hearing Conservation Association, or NHCA. By the way, that society has as its mission to prevent hearing loss in all sectors of society. And if you attend the meetings of these organizations, you hear things about human factors research, of course. And as an example, at Virginia Tech, we've taken some preliminary measurements of the sound output level of various combinations of a music player, that is the actual device which reads the music off of the media and amplifies it, together with the earphones, which would be present at the ear. And we've taken those measurements of sound level output at various gain or volume settings using our acoustic mannequins. What we can say, at least at this point, from these mannequin and artificial ear measurements is that it's typical for devices to have fairly high volume capability. And in some cases, the capabilities can be hazardous to the ear if they are played at high settings for extended wearing periods. And I emphasize here that the risk to people's hearing is really not just a function of the sound intensity. The risk to hearing is a function of energy that impacts the ear, and that energy depends on not just the sound intensity in decibels, but also the duration of the exposure. So it's not just how loud it is, but it's for how long it's played. And in our samples, and they are certainly not a complete exhaustive sample of all devices available, we find that there are some products that can output music at 105 decibels, A-weighted, and even higher if we just look at the peaks that are present in the music. And to put that in perspective, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which governs noise exposure in industry, and of course that's a different problem, but OSHA would only allow 105 decibels A-weighted noise exposure during a workday in the occupational setting for a maximum of 1 hour, and no other exposure above 80 decibels A-weighted for any duration for the rest of the day. So, you know, given that these earbud-type devices can be worn for long periods of time, the point is that exposures above safe levels are indeed possible. Now, really, though, what's needed is a definitive study to determine how are people behaving with the devices. And we don't have the final answer on that. Users' behavior with their earphones greatly influences the amount of risk to their hearing because they're the ones that are controlling the volume and they're the ones that are wearing the devices for certain periods during a typical day. And that's definitely going to be the final arbiter in terms of exposure risk to their hearing.
You mentioned earbuds, and those are something that, when I was younger and listening to music, most of our earphones sat on the outside of the ears. But have you done any research to the design of earbuds themselves with respect to noise exposure?
Yes, we have, and we've looked at both the insert or earbud type of device where the sound output port is 20 millimeters or so from the eardrum. And we've also looked at over-the-ear devices that you mentioned that fit over the external ear, more of an earmuff style device. And the measurements that we've taken on both those types of products have been measurements of the noise exclusion of the product, or what we call external noise attenuation, how much they reduce the ambient noise before it gets to the ear. And we've done those studies with basic passive attenuation earplugs, earbuds that just simply block the sound. And we've also looked at devices that are special devices that cancel the noise through electronic means. They physically cancel the noise, and also most of them provide some of the passive attenuation as well. Basically, what you find is that most of the devices provide some noise attenuation, but there's a very, very high variance across devices. There are some devices that are obviously specifically designed to exclude a lot of the external noise, and that's a big advantage because the more noise attenuation, the more noise exclusion provided by the device, the better that signal-to-noise ratio is at the ear. So the result is that the user doesn't have to turn up the volume as high to overcome the background noise to hear the signal, the music, the book on CD, whatever they want to be hearing. And this is, in my opinion, a very important factor in reducing exposures. That is, the user doesn't have to turn up the volume to overcome, say, the noise on the street, if they're walking on the street, or the noise in the gymnasium, or the noise in the industrial plant, if the earpiece has good attenuation of external noise. Having said all that, we do have some of the data about noise exclusion, noise attenuation, but earphone manufacturers don't typically publish quantitative noise reduction data in their advertising. That is, unless their device is being marketed as a hearing protection device specifically. But for most of the music rendition type earbuds, for example, the consumer can't compare different earbuds on an objective basis with respect to this noise exclusion property.
We've had a chance to talk about some of the issues of hearing loss, but are there any other issues with these devices as far as presenting safety or other concerns while using these earphones?
Well, I think there are, and, you know, on a larger plane, I guess I'm personally convinced that because the ear is now being used for so much input of information, that we are perhaps overloading it, overloading from the standpoint of too much energy at the ear, which can be a noise-induced hearing loss issue, but also just simply isolating the person. The person is now wearing earphones, perhaps in both ears, often in both ears, in fact, and that can be a very isolating experience, but not one that the user really thinks about as an isolating experience. I mean, if you're listening to music, and particularly at high volume levels, you're essentially immersed in the music. So that's definitely an issue. And we talked earlier about the good qualities about a high attenuation earphone. That is, it cuts down on the ambient noise. But that can be a two-edged sword in itself, because while it would cut down on external sounds, you know, thereby reducing the need for turning the music up too high, it also cuts down on the hearing of signals that are from the outside that we may need to attend to, like, for example, sirens, audio signals that are associated with a crosswalk. On city streets, certainly, you know, a car horn is a major defensive weapon for the driver. Some would say offensive, but you need to be able to hear car horns as a pedestrian, and you may not hear them under some of these earphones and earbuds. I had a very, very troubling experience in riding a bicycle on a trail that was basically a converted railroad trail that had been converted to a bike path, and I was coming down a steep hill on my bicycle, and I saw a jogger that was ahead of me, probably 75 to 100 feet ahead. And trying to follow the rules of the trail, I shouted three times, "Pass on your left, pass on your left," as loudly as I could. And she was on the right, so I figured I had plenty of room to pass on the left because she was forewarned, as we are supposed to do. Little did I know that she was listening to her music player through earbuds and heard nothing of what I said. And as I got right beside her, she turned to the left right into me. And, you know, that's a clear example of where the person wearing the earphones is just simply isolated or insulated from the outside world. So I guess, you know, for all these reasons, earphones of current design really should not be worn in situations where the user needs to hear external sounds, like walking on a city sidewalk. And people shouldn't occlude their ears when driving vehicles, because, you know, not only does it reduce your ability to detect traffic-related sounds, it can affect your ability to localize sounds in your environment, which is not a good thing when driving. Now, I will say that I believe that the technology is now available. In fact, we are trying to work on some new technology to overcome these types of problems. And hopefully, in the next couple of years, you should see some improvements. I think there are technologically viable solutions that are under the realm of smart earphones. That is, earphones which can sense and respond to users' needs, for example. They would be adapting, perhaps, to the acoustic environment and provide optimal hearing when needed, but also reduced exposure for the wearer. That is, an all-in-one type device and functioning in these environments so that, you know, there's some protection of hearing, there is some pleasure gain from the source that's being listened to, but, you know, when there's a more important source, a warning, for example, an audio warning, a person may be able to hear that through the earphone. So clearly, we have the technology to do that, and I believe that we will see it before too long.
Excellent. We've had a chance to talk about some of the downsides of noise and hearing and things like that. One of the things that I remember working on in your lab quite a bit was communications and communications under noisy environments. And in particular, one of the areas was that of pilot communications.
Yes.
Which, if you've ever been in a small aircraft, is really quite a noisy environment. What type of research have you been doing recently with regards to hearing and this type of noisy environments where you, as you just mentioned, really do want to be able to hear some of the other things that are going on? And perhaps can this technology be used to increase your awareness of what's going on around you?
Yes, that's a great question. And, you know, we would call that increasing of awareness probably an improvement in situational awareness, particularly for a pilot that needs to know information about weather or certain flight paths or changes in those flight paths, other air traffic, et cetera. And in the cockpit, whether it's private pilot, military pilot, commercial pilot, a lot of information is coming over the communications channel that's, you know, brought through the sense of hearing. So we are very concerned about the design of headsets for use in the cockpit. Why a headset? Because many of the cockpits are noisy, and we need to exclude the ambient noise that's inherent in the cockpit so that the pilot, co-pilot, can hear the communications that's coming from air traffic control and either other sources. Human factors research has really been at the forefront of improvement of communications technology in the cockpit. I mean, one example would be developments in active noise cancellation. These are techniques for electronically capturing an offensive noise, the background noise of the cockpit, for example, and feeding it back through a conditioning system within the headset that will cancel the noise at the earphone. So essentially, the pilot or co-pilot wearing the headset doesn't even experience the original noise. It's not blocking the noise, it's canceling it. And this is effective, fortuitously effective, for low-frequency noise below about 1,000 hertz. And that noise is prevalent in many cockpits, particularly turboprop cockpits. So we've been working with that technology and conducting some studies with it.
How have human factors studies determined which of these aspects in headset design are critical?
Well, we have recently done some work in our flight simulator, and I was fortunate to have a student who was a commercial pilot before he came to us. He was trained at Embry-Riddle. His name's Brian Vallemont. He's since completed his PhD, and he wanted to do a dissertation on headsets and how they impacted flight safety, basically. So we set up a study in our flight simulator. We had pilots fly a very high workload flight with a lot of communications imposed in the flight for 3.5 hours. And they had to come back for 4 flights of 3.5 hours. In each flight, they used 1 of 4 headsets. Some of these headsets were popular passive headsets with none of that cancellation I talked about. Others had cancellation built into them. And we were taking measures of the headset's effects on many of the kinds of measures that we typically use in human factors engineering. For example, the noise attenuation at different sound frequencies or pitches. That's an important measure that goes to effectiveness in reducing hearing loss. We also took measures about the speech intelligibility. For example, we measured how many times the pilot asked for a readback of the message that was just spoken by air traffic control. And obviously, the more the readbacks ask for, the less the speech intelligibility, and perhaps, you know, the poorer the frequency response and communications quality under the headset. So those are some of the types of measures that we've taken.
I see. One of the things that I have a question on is, did the choice of a headset affect any of the flight performance? That is, did pilots or were they able to fly better with a particular choice or the choice of a particular headset?
Yes, and that's a question that's a bottom line type question that's often overlooked. Backing up just a step, it was quite clear that certain headsets had advantages over others in how protective they were or the percent speech intelligibility they delivered to the pilot. But we've come to realize in human factors research that those are strictly piecemeal type measures. They're only part of the picture. And what you're talking about, I think, would be, you know, bottom line operational performance effectiveness. And in this one study, you know, which is just one example of many, we found that a better headset, that is one which protected better, provided better speech intelligibility, pilots rated as more comfortable, they accepted it, etc., really resulted in bottom line performance of flying the aircraft better. And we took measures of that were very objective. For example, flight performance measures such as the pilot's deviation over that 3.5 hour flight from a directed heading, magnetic heading, or the pilot's deviation from a directed airspeed or directed altitude. And as deviations increase, obviously performance, flight performance and control has decreased. And we found that holding everything else constant except the headset, the better the headset, the better the performance on those flight control measures. And I think we can say that that has safety implications.
Fantastic. That's all we have for today.
Steve, we've known each other for many years, probably 15, and I've seen you go through your undergraduate program, graduate program, and now you're a very successful human factors engineer in industry, and you've designed a number of products. I'm really curious, as an industrial engineer way back when, how did you gain an interest in specializing in the field of human factors?
The answer to that question is I either have you to blame or you to give the credit for that. I'm not sure if you remember, but you were the instructor for the first course, you were the professor for the first course that I ever took in human factors. And I think what I found most interesting about it was that it didn't just focus on the ability to build things for the sake of building things. You were human factors focuses on how people interact with technology, and really at the core of that as to how you can make technology improve people's lives. And that was something that I found very appealing then, and really haven't regretted one bit from that point moving forward through a number of years of school, and then having an opportunity to have been practicing that for about the last 10 years. So I think the simple answer is really an opportunity to improve technology to make it both usable and useful for people.
Well, that wasn't a loaded question about the course. In fact, I had actually forgotten that you were in that Introduction to Human Factors course way back when. But, you know, there's no greater reward for a professor than to see a student go on to great success, and you've certainly done that. One of the things that I've, of course, witnessed is the fact that you've been involved in really the design of a number of products from concept to phase out. And in fact, you won an award from the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society. A particular technical group gave you an award for one particular product. And I just wonder if you could give us your perspective on where human factors engineering fits into the product design cycle and how to implement human factors in consumer product design particularly.
One of the very interesting things about being involved in product development within industry is you get to see almost a separation between how things might be done if you could do them in an ideal situation and sometimes how things come to happen. Unfortunately, in industry, oftentimes things come to happen perhaps without a really good reason for bringing them to be. For example, a company may decide to release a product because that's their core competency, and they are trying to release a product that they feel will help them sell their services and things like that. Very carefully avoiding any use of the word end user or consumer, because sometimes that doesn't play or come into play within corporations. They have organizations come into being for a particular reason, and they try to continue to fulfill that reason, even though sometimes that need may have passed. Where human factors fits into this is from a very early stage with needs analysis, to be able to say, hey, here are some things that people could do, while simultaneously keeping an eye on the technology to understand what technology can deliver. We can begin to create concepts and ideas to help improve people's lives through the introduction of new products. There are many, many products out there that we don't necessarily need and sometimes don't really want. But when you have the opportunity to be involved in the design of a product that really has the ability to impact positively people's lives and you see their reaction to it, that's done in a way where because of their feedback, you've been able to create this. And that's really where human factors comes into the product design process.
Okay. Well, now that you're sort of a veteran of the product design process, as demonstrated by the fact that you've led the development of several products that have come to market, you're now giving back something to the human factors community in that you're teaching workshops. And I noticed that beginning of this conference, you taught a workshop that had a very catchy title to it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the things that we began doing, and we started this program last year, is the introduction of a workshop at each human factors meeting entitled The Design Chautauqua. The name itself comes from the Chautauqua Institute, which is a location on Lake Chautauqua in upstate New York, a very creative design community. No affiliation with this organization other than we've shamelessly adopted their name. But what it allows us to do, because so much of the work we do is multidisciplinary, it's impossible to be an expert in all areas. But we need to have a great exposure to a variety of different areas. So at each Chautauqua, we take a different topic, sub-area of design, and have the opportunity to meet with people who are experts in that particular area of design during the morning. We share their facilities. Frequently, we go on tours. And then in the afternoon, we take more of a business school approach and have a variety of different sessions, each focusing on the application of that particular area of technology within the product design process. And the last 2 years have been very successful. Last year, the topic was industrial design, more of a physical design approach, and how industrial designers work. And this year, we began our session focusing on a very specific form of needs analysis, which is design ethnography, and how to begin really gathering information from users at the onset to help shape the product design cycle, which will follow.
Very good. Steve, it's really been a pleasure doing this interview with you, and I can tell you those of us that teach at Virginia Tech are very proud to have had you as a student and to witness the contributions you've made since you've left our university.
Thank you very much. Fantastic experience.